Medical Recovery Services versus Getford, docket number 47208. Here on behalf of the appellant, we have Mr. Cutler. Here on behalf of the respondent, we have Kelly Dove. The parties are all present. Mr. Cutler, are you prepared to go forward with argument?
I am, Your Honor.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. May it please the court. This case presents two issues. First, the proper interpretation of Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 54D1B governing the prevailing party determinations. And second, the proper interpretation of Idaho Code Section 12-120 subsection 3 governing awards of attorney's fees in certain cases. But unless the court has pressing questions, before addressing the merits, I'd like to briefly address the elephant in the room. Why is Medical Recovery Services litigating in the Court of Appeals over attorney's fees in a case involving a $416 debt paid shortly after the service of the complaint? That's a fair question. And the short answer is that this case presents a recurring issue, and this court's guidance is needed for not only this case, but every case with a similar fact pattern that comes after it. Medical Recovery Services is in the thankless business of collecting medical debt on behalf of Idaho healthcare providers. For better or worse, the current healthcare model depends on collecting payments from individuals who receive medical services. Court costs and attorney's fees are recurring expenses associated with collecting these payments from individuals who haven't timely paid their medical bills. If debtors are allowed to delay paying their debt until after being served with a lawsuit, and then they're able to avoid liability for costs and attorney's fees by paying the balance of the debt owed after service of the complaint, it would significantly impact not only Medical Recovery's business, but also its healthcare provider clients, increasing the overall costs of collecting unpaid bills for medical services. So again, this case is about more than attorney's fees on a $416 debt. Medical Recovery and its healthcare provider clients need guidance from this court on how to handle this recurring fact pattern. Now, if the court's
Miller, yes. I just want to clarify something. Is that the argument you want to make in this case where there is no evidence in the record that Mr. Getford actually received notice of any of the claims until the complaint was served?
Your Honor, there is evidence in the record that Mr. Getford received the bill from his healthcare provider and knew that it was a bill. He didn't appreciate at the time, according to the district court's finding that based on, you know, medication, but he did know that he received services and he did know that he got a document from his healthcare provider.
And he thought his insurance company had paid it.
He did think that, but it's undisputed because he didn't contest summary judgment that the debt was owed and that he didn't pay it on time and that he admitted that judgment should be entered against him because he had already paid it after the lawsuit was filed. So this is a case in which...
Why did Medical Recovery Services ask Mr. Getford to stipulate to the summary judgment or the default or what for $0 when they knew he had already paid the bill? I mean, if their goal is to recover money on behalf of the client, that had been done.
They need to get the case to a judgment. And my understanding is that there wasn't a stipulation with Mr. Getford as much as he just didn't file a response. So once Mr. Getford had paid after the case was filed, And it's important to note that at this point in the case, there's no evidence that Mr. Getford has not received, other than his answer. There's nothing to suggest that he wasn't receiving the letters and things like that. Because if you look at the record, Mr. Getford called Medical Recovery Services prior to filing this lawsuit.
Isn't the finding below that Medical Recovery Services sent the demand notices to a non-existent incorrect address?
The demand notices were sent to the same address that Mr. Getford admits he received the bill from his medical provider. And yes, there is a finding by the magistrate court upheld by the district court that the notices were not received by Mr. Getford, but they're the same address that he did receive the bill.
Did you challenge that finding in your opening brief?
I believe we've challenged the findings before the district court. And I'm not sure that we challenged the finding specifically in the opening brief or not at this point. I could look at that for you and get that to you in the reply. But in any event, I think it's irrelevant with respect to the material questions before this court, which are, you know, whether when a debt is owed, because there is a judgment in this case, the summary judgment that was granted establishes that Mr. Getford owed the debt. He didn't pay it until after the complaint was filed, and then he did pay it afterwards. So the judgment that was requested.
Yes. As I understood Judge Husky's question, which I'm not sure you've answered, why did your client seek summary judgment after the debt had already been paid?
Because they needed to get the case to a final judgment in order to file an attorney's fees motion.
Go ahead, Judge Lorello.
But haven't you argued on appeal that you don't need a judgment?
You don't need a judgment to be a prevailing party. But for procedurally, to file a motion for attorney's fees, the timing under the rules of civil procedure is governed by entry of judgment. So you have 14 days upon entry of judgment to file a motion for attorney's fees. And under the governing Idaho law, you don't raise attorney's fees. They're not a claim in a complaint. They're a post-judgment matter that's filed after a judgment is entered. And the prevailing party status is determined based on the course of the action. If there's a judgment, then you look at the judgment. But if there's not a judgment, or you can look outside of the judgment at what the relief was. Maybe there's a partial judgment. You know, in this case, a judgment for $0 because part of it had already been paid. But under Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 54D1B, this court looks at the final judgment or the result of the action in relation to the relief sought by the respective parties. But in order to be able to file that motion for attorney's fees, that memorandum of attorney's fees and costs, you need a judgment to be entered. And so that's, I think, the practical issue that medical recovery faces and would like some guidance from the court on. When somebody pays after the complaint has been filed, what do they do to get the case to a judgment and then be able to file their attorney's fees motion? And if there's a different posture or a different procedure to do that than what was done here, you know, I don't think there's any objection from medical recovery service to be being advised on that. But I think what they did here works. They moved for summary judgment, basically acknowledging that there was a payment made, that there was liability for the amount that was asked for, $416, a payment made of $416 that went to that liability. And so therefore $0 in outstanding liability, except for the prejudgment interest, which was ultimately granted as well.
Is it your position that the payment to the medical care provider was the basis that MRS was prevailing on?
That's correct. The claim that medical recovery prevailed on was collecting $416 for its creditor client. Under the Idaho...
So I'm aware that you were not counsel below, Mr. Cutler, but are you aware that in the appeal to the district court that medical recovery services argued Getford's payment to the medical care provider of $416 is no payment to MRS as a matter of law?
I am aware of that statement in the brief. I mean, it was an alternative argument, is my understanding of that argument. And I think, you know, the better argument is, you know, reviewing the statutes, is that in these types of cases, the collection agency and the debtor can't be distinguished. And it's not a problem for that argument to have been raised in the reply brief in this case, because Mr. Getford, again, was pro se before the district court and raised the issue asking for the Oklahoma rule to be applied and for that distinction between medical recovery services and its client, VVA in this case, in his response brief for the first time. So,
but aren't you switching sides on us? You know, below you were saying that payment of $416 was no payment to MRS. And now the basis for you saying that MRS is a prevailing party is because that payment was made. Haven't you switched sides of the argument?
There is some inconsistency, but the first argument that was made is the one on summary judgment and the summary judgment that was granted. And on summary judgment, if you look at the affidavits, let me find it here in my notes, the affidavit of Ms. Haddon at record 43 and the summary judgment brief at record 31 to 32 is Ms. Haddon's affidavit. Record 43 is the summary judgment brief, and record 91 is the granting of the summary judgment. If you look at that's the operative summary judgment motion and the judgment that was granted, or the basis for the original judgment. And in that motion, Ms. Haddon states that there was a $416 debt, there was a payment made of $416, and that based on that payment, the liability was established, and there's $0 outstanding. So to the extent there's an inconsistency in one brief made to the district court, that inconsistency is the one that this court should ignore. And it's the consistent position that was the basis for the summary judgment in this case, and is the argument in the reply brief in response to Mr. Getford's new arguments that this court should follow.
Is it, and I understand that medical recovery services perhaps might need some guidance on the most appropriate process for them. I want to understand, when you said this is sort of a recurring theme, is it a recurring theme that if a complaint is filed and the outstanding debt is paid, that medical recovery services seek summary judgment in the amount of $0 for purposes of getting attorney fees?
I know they have done that more than once, and I think that they have tried to, they've done different things. I think in one case they moved to dismiss because you're basically saying we've been paid, so we no longer need to proceed. And then someone said that a court said that by dismissing, they were conceding that they didn't prevail. And so they tried the moving for summary judgment. I think they faced this a number of times and are facing a practical problem of what is the proper procedure to get to the attorney's fees stage of the case once a party concedes liability and pays the debt to their provider, which is something that happens not infrequently.
Thank you.
So I'd like to go to the statutory issue briefly and then return to the prevailing party analysis, because I think the statutory issue is relatively straightforward. Medical recovery has argued throughout this case that there are kind of two categories of available fee shifting in Idaho Code Section 12-120, subsection 3. The first category is efforts to collect on a debt, you know, whether that's an open account, an account stated, a bill, a negotiable instrument, guarantee, or a contract for services, as in this case. And then there's a second option, which is in cases where it's any commercial transaction, not for personal or household services. Now, those are two separate baskets, basically, that you can get fee shifting under. And that's just the plain text of the statute, and that's what we've argued throughout this case. If you look at this court's cases, all the way back to Erickson versus Blue Cross of Idaho Health Services, 116 Idaho 693, at 695, this court rejected the very argument that Mr. Getford makes, that the commercial transaction requirement applies to both halves of the statute. And that's been consistently held all the way through Neumeier, or Medical Recovery Services versus Neumeier in the Idaho Supreme Court in 2018. That's at 163 Idaho 504 at 513. And this ruling makes sense because if you take Mr. Getford's reading of the statute, you swallow everything that comes before any commercial transaction. A negotiable instrument, an open account, a guarantee, a contract relating to the purchase of sale or services, all of those are transactions that fit within the broad definition of all transactions, not for personal or household services. So if you apply the personal and household services definition to the full statute, then you basically swallowed everything that comes before in any commercial transaction, making the rest of the statute surplusage. So,
but alternatively, if you construe the statute to have two prongs, then don't you render superfluous the definition of a commercial transaction as not including personal or household services?
No, Your Honor. And the reason that you don't do that is because the first half of the statute is talking about a very specific, narrow type of claim. To recover on an open account, meaning that to recover the debt, something non-payment, is basically the first half of the statute. Non-payment of an open account, non-payment of an account stated, note, bill, negotiable instrument, guarantee, contract relating to the purchase of sale or goods, wares, merchandise, or services. The second half includes a broader set of claims. So for example, in the Carrillo case that the opposing counsel cites, you know, it was a tire contract, but the claim wasn't whether they had paid for the tire services. The claim was whether there was some problem associated with the tire work done that created liability down the line. So that in any commercial transaction applies to a broader set of claims than the first half of the statute. The first half of the statute is narrowly focused on claims for payment of, you know, an account, or in this case, a services contract. And that's consistently the way it's been interpreted for 30 years, especially in particular, most on point in Erickson versus Blue Cross, 116 Idaho 693, which this court held and expressly rejected the argument that Mr. Getford is making 30 years ago. And so for stare decisis reasons, as well as the plain language, this court should reaffirm that decision and not change where it's going. So with the remaining time, unless the court has more questions on the statutory issue, I'd like to spend some time on the prevailing party analysis. Under Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 54D1B, the court, whether it's the district court or the magistrate court, is limited to the factors and the criteria set forth in the rule. Of particular importance, the court must consider the final judgment or the result of the action in relation to the relief sought by the respective parties. The issue that's present here is the one identified in Clark versus Latimer, 165 Idaho 1, page 6, cited at the opening brief on pages 11 to 12, and in the reply argued again, starting around page 3. The problem in Clark versus Latimer was that the court overlooked that the judgment actually received. It was a single issue case like this one, and the party had prevailed on the single issue before the court. But the court thought the issue was esoteric or legally inconsequential, or rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic was the phrase that the court used. And the Idaho Supreme Court reversed the decision not to grant prevailing party status because the court had focused on issues outside of the action. Just like this court focused on issues with respect to the pre-litigation diligence or alleged lack thereof. The focus on those.
But isn't that the alternative ruling by the magistrate court? I mean, both were affirmed by the district court, but the original ruling by the, or the primary ruling is that Medical Recovery Services took zero in judgment and for that reason recovered nothing. And that was the reason that the court concluded that there was not a prevailing party, that MRS was not a prevailing party.
And that analysis is in error as well. And I think they're both, I mean, I'm not sure that it's fair to say one's an alternative ruling versus the other. I think they were both made together and supported the court's analysis. But the idea that $0 is taking nothing is inconsistent with the record and inconsistent with the summary judgment brief the court had granted. The brief states that $416 were owed and a $416 payment was made after service, and that for that reason, you know, $0 is the amount outstanding. I'm not sure what other judgment Medical Recovery Service could obtain at that point and still be consistent with its obligations under the Idaho Collection Agency Act, which allows for attorney's fees. So the focus on the $0 judgment is also in error because it omits from its analysis the result of the action in relation to the relief sought by the respective parties. Medical Recovery Services sought $416 and obtained a payment to its creditor client of $416. Again, if you take this case out of the context of debt collection, if I bring a claim for $416 and someone pays my brother $416 and I say, that's okay. Yeah, I accept that payment to my brother as $416. And I'm, you know, moved to end the case. I don't think the fact that the payment is to somebody else prevents me from being a prevailing party if I've obtained a payment from the other side.
Doesn't that turn on the nature of the assignment between the parties?
It in part, you could say that it turns on the nature of the assignment, but I'm not sure that that is material because, again, in my hypothetical, there's no assignment. They paid my brother, but if I accept that and I perhaps have a side agreement with my brother that says, hey, you're going to pay this to me, I think as long as the party who's has the right to be paid accepts the payment, whoever it's to, and recognizes that payment and credits it to their account, I think, you know, the fact that they obtained the payment from the other side in the amount they requested is what should be material to this court's analysis. So I'm going to address that briefly in a little bit more detail with respect to the statute, because I think the statute is important in this case because debt collection assignments are different than other assignments. And again, I think there's more briefing on this in the reply brief, but I would note that, again, Mr. Getford raised the argument of this distinction between the creditor client and the debt collector in his response brief for the first time. I don't think you'll find that in any of the briefing below, an argument specifically to distinguish payment to Medical Recovery versus payment to the creditor client. But in any case, the Idaho Debt Collection Act and the Supreme Court's decision in Medical Recovery Services versus Strawn, 156 Idaho 153 at 158, makes clear that there's a difference between a debt collection assignment under Idaho law and a typical assignment. Debt collectors collect on behalf of their creditor clients. They're not a traditional assignor who can refuse to acknowledge a payment to another party when that party is the creditor client.
Can't that be a isn't that part of the relationship that the debt collector and the medical care provider enter into? You can either have a complete assignment where the debt collector takes on the risk and all of the upside of collecting it. They collect it, they get to keep it. Or it can be just an assignment for limited purposes of collecting upon the on behalf of the medical care provider, in which event then the debt collector gets some sort of fee or something, but they don't get the whole collect the whole amount.
No, Your Honor. My understanding is that if you are a regulated debt collector in Idaho, you are required to have this more limited relationship with your creditor clients. You're not allowed to take a greater assignment. The statute establishes what fees you're able to charge if you're in the business of collecting debt, and establishes the relationship, including duties to account for payments made to the creditor client, even if they're not made directly to you as the collection agent. And that's specifically at statute. The statute is Idaho Code 26-2234, Section 5, which says all monies collected on behalf of creditors' clients and all payments made to such creditor clients have to be accounted to. It's an accounting requirement. There's a bond requirement, and there's an openness and fair dealing requirement. Our client had an obligation to credit Mr. Getford the amount that was paid to his provider to be fair and open and honest. If they had done anything else, you know, they would be misleading Mr. Getford and doing things that are inconsistent with their duties as a collection agent. So I'd also just briefly like to address, if the court doesn't have specific questions, the issues with the court's consideration of the pre-litigation diligence from a Rule 408 and settlement negotiation standpoint. Whether or not Medical Recovery Services, you know, engages in some form of settlement effort in cases in which a debt is owed and hasn't been paid, and so there's a breach of contract at issue, is not an issue that this court wades into, or that the court below should have waded into. Rule 408 protects settlement discussions from being used to support or defend a claim. And the court's decisions in Idaho First National Bank versus Bliss Valley, 121 Idaho 266 at 276, says there's no duty to conduct a reasonable settlement negotiations. And Ross versus Coleman.
Mr. Butler,
yes.
I was actually a little confused by this argument in the briefing. Yeah. What specifically are you talking about that the court considered that you think the court should not have considered?
Whether or not Mr. Getford received notice of this before we filed a lawsuit.
So that's what I understood the argument in the briefing to be, but isn't the notice issue relevant under the statute?
Not to section.
Isn't that why the court is discussing it at all? It's not really a settlement negotiation point. It's a notice point.
It's not relevant to Idaho Code 12-120, subsection 3.
Correct, but below, MRS raised the issue of 12-120 sub 1, which it is relevant to, which is why the court was considering it.
And if the court was considering it only on that issue, then it wouldn't be a basis to preclude, the diligence finding wouldn't be a basis to preclude a reversal on the 12-120 subsection 3. So I think that the lower court's decisions are not necessarily clear in dividing up the analysis between 12-120 subsection 1 and section 12-120 subsection 3. And so I think it gets cross-considered, and I think it would be inappropriate to consider it for purposes of 12-120 subsection 3. And so And that's, I think, where the court goes amiss. So, because if there's no diligence issue, if you take that out of the criteria, then you only have one claim in this case, which is a claim for payment of $416, which payment was made after service of the complaint, and summary judgment was granted for the outstanding liability, which was $0 at that point. And that's the only issue and complaint in the case. So it's a single issue case in which we recovered $416 for our creditor client. That payment was credited, and then we obtained prejudgment interest. So it's a single issue case where we got everything we wanted, and it's under the same cases like this court has held in 18 Mile Ranch and others, where if you get the best result that you could possibly get for your client, then you are a prevailing party as a matter of law. And so we would ask this court to reverse the decisions of the district court and to find that Medical Recovery Services was a prevailing party as a matter of law, or in the alternative, the error was made in considering the prevailing party analysis as well as the statutory error. And I'd reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Cutler. Ms. Dove, do you have a response?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry, it took me just a moment to unmute myself. I'd like to start with the prevailing party analysis, and I believe it was Your Honor's initial question about, is this the right case to test that question? Because here, the lower court found that Mr. Gepford did not receive notice in advance of the filing of the complaint. It additionally found that had he received notice, he would have paid the bill. And as everybody recognizes and is beyond dispute, MRS moved for $0 on summary judgment and got a judgment of $0. I understand Mr. Cutler's question about what the correct procedure might be in cases where a debtor might pay the full amount following the filing of a complaint. But as the statutory scheme in subsection 1, as well as the public policy of the state reflect, the goal is to enable a debtor to pay the debt in advance of filing a complaint and thereby avoid litigation altogether where possible. And while MRS has abandoned its claim for fees under subsection 1, subsection 1 really drives that policy, and for reasons I'll get to in a moment, we don't believe subsection 3 applies. So here we have a situation where the notices were sent to the wrong address. That's not disputed. Mr. Gepford attached a letter from MRS to his original opposition to his motion, the motion for attorney's fees. It's at page 62 in the record and reflects MRS's realization that they sent the notices to the wrong address. To the extent he received notices or those notices actually made it to him, they were not introduced until the second appeal. So they were introduced very, very late in the litigation and we would contend waived. At that point, the notices, which I believe are around page 33 to 35 of the record, do not show either the name of Valley View Associates, who were the original medical providers. They do not show Mr. Gepford's name, and they do not show the amount due and owing. So even to the extent there's some issue with whether these notices actually made it to Mr. Gepford's residence or mailing address, they were inadequate under subsection 1 of the fee statute, or in general, to apprise Mr. Gepford of the amount due and owing. Following MRS's filing of this complaint in 2016, Mr. Gepford paid the amount in full in about 2 weeks. And here we are 4 years later, after countless motions for reconsideration and appeals all over the fees issue about whether Mr. Gepford should be responsible for all of MRS's fees, even though he paid this amount in full within 2 weeks of the filing of the complaint. So I don't think this is a good test case for what should happen when the system perhaps works as it's intended, which is that the debtor receives the notice of the amount due, refuses to pay it before suit is brought, and then the debtor pays the amount in full. So I would hesitate to comment on what MRS might be entitled to recover or entitled to do in that scenario, but that is not the scenario here. And prevailing party analysis, as Your Honors are well aware, is the discretionary standard. And
if I can interrupt for just a moment before you move on to the prevailing party discussion, just so I'm sure I understand your argument. Notwithstanding any preservation concerns regarding when the notice, I guess, evidence was presented below, and setting aside for a moment your argument that subsection 3 doesn't apply, are you arguing that the notice provision that's expressly referenced in subsection 1 but not referenced in subsection 3 still is relevant because it's the policy underlying the attorney's fee awards?
Well, I think it's the policy underlying the recovery of fees there, certainly, and it's also consistent with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and this state's interpretation of that act and its own act, which is to avoid litigation where possible and allow a debtor to make that payment. And to the point about MRS's argument that this was pre-litigation conduct that should not be taken into account, While they've withdrawn their claim for fees under subsection 1, their complaint explicitly alleges in paragraph 8 that they had provided Mr. Gepford with this notice. So this isn't purely pre-litigation because it was alleged in their complaint and it did bear out to not be true or not entirely true. So along with the not just the mere fact that Mr. Gepford didn't receive notice, but that based on his testimony and behavior in this case, the district court or the magistrate court and affirmed by the district court explicitly found that he would have made this payment had he received notice before the suit. So in this case, the court looked at the totality of the circumstances here and the fact that MRS ultimately sought and recovered $0 on summary judgment and declined to find that MRS was the prevailing party. But that aside, most of this litigation has really, of course, centered around fees. A lot of the underlying briefing, and indeed until MRS withdrew their position in their reply brief, certainly centered around subsection 1. I can't speculate as to why they withdrew that, but that is now, of course, off the table as a source of fees. But it was hotly contested in the entire duration of this litigation for the past approximately 4 years. We don't think they're entitled to fees under subsection 3. MRS cited in their reply brief Erickson, a 1989 Idaho Court of Appeals case, as well as one other pre-1990 Court of Appeals case that does support their textual reading of the statute. However, in our answering brief, I believe around pages 24 to 29, we listed numerous Idaho Supreme Court cases that have been from the last 10 years that all post-date Erickson, that all post-date their authority, and that all say a commercial transaction is at the heart of the availability of fees under subpart 3. That authority is controlling over Erickson and over the reading that they're urging. Their reply brief does not engage with a single one of those cases we cited from the Idaho Supreme Court, does not engage with the cases we distinguished. And on the basis of authority, each of those cases makes explicit that a commercial transaction is required to recover fees under subsection 3. I'm sure your honors have read the brief, so I don't need to belabor that unless you have questions, but everything from, they're all explicit. Great Plains Equipment, Idaho Transportation Department, the commercial transaction requirement has to be the gravamen of the action for there to be fees available under subsection 3. So even if there were some discomfort with the prevailing party analysis, MRS would still not be entitled to fees under subsection 3 here. Let's see, just
do any of those Idaho Supreme Court cases that you have listed, either, you know, in your brief or some of which you've recited here, dig into the statutory language and explain why some of it may be surplusage or not?
I believe they do. And in fact, I in my noting each of them, Kramer v. Slater, and that's Kramer with a C, explicitly deals with medical services as well. So it's a case where there's payment and contract and issues for medical services. And also just to note that, and I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but the New Miller case, which is an MRS case, that case did appear to give a debtor in a case against MRS fees against MRS, but I have not seen fees awarded in MRS in MRS's or another debt collector's favor under subsection 3. And in that case, the court did not analyze the statutory language at all. But there's so many of these cases on this issue that it seems that it's become a principle of black letter law under Idaho law that subsection 3 requires a commercial transaction, to the point where it's cited the Idaho Supreme Court cases collect authority, cite that authority and move forward. And it's hardly a matter of discussion other than considering whether the transaction at issue is commercial or not commercial. So just to put a pin in the prevailing party analysis, if your honors don't have any other questions, I'd make one more distinction between this case and the Clark case that was cited. First of all, the idea that the prevailing party analysis cannot go beyond the scope of the action is not a well-established principle and was raised for the very first time, I believe, in the reply brief. I could not locate it anywhere else as an argument that was made. Nor could I find concrete support for that principle, other than the language says in the action. But the Clark case that MRS cites in support of the supposed fact that you can't look beyond the four corners of the action really doesn't hold anything like that at all. The brief says that pre-litigation diligence and then includes a quote, you know, can't be part of that analysis, essentially. But that's not what Clark said. Clark went back to the language that Mr. Cutler quoted about rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic and noted that the court in Clark thought that the victory that the plaintiffs had obtained was not meaningful because they were all in the end going after the same money. And the Court on Appeals disagreed, and I'll wrap up, and thought that it gave them another source of recovery and therefore was a victory. And just to conclude, I would note that had Mr. Gepfer gotten notice, this past nearly 5 years of litigation could have been avoided. And while perhaps some direction about what MRS or a similar entity should take, what action that entity should take in this kind of situation where a debtor pays the price in full following the conclusion or following the filing of the complaint, this is not a good test case for that question. I don't have any further questions. I will conclude. Thank you.
Ms. Dove, I actually have a question. Okay. You cut out a little bit there.
I'm sorry.
I don't know for everyone, but is it your position that the Idaho Supreme Court decisions that have held that a commercial transaction is required for fees under subsection 3 is consistent with the plain language of subsection 3?
I do think it's consistent with subsection 3 plain language. There is that and in the middle where there's a list of items and then it says and in commercial transactions. But I think to read it otherwise would render the distinction between the personal and commercial as surplusage and the first part of that meaningless. And in fact, one of the reading that MRS is urging that as long as it's a contract for services or a contract, I forget exactly the language, but a contract for services, that it qualifies under subsection 3. I believe Kramer v. Slater is a case that explicitly refutes that reading by saying it's not enough that it's a contract for services. It has to be commercial. So I think it is consistent with the plain language. Arguably, you know, that the and might be construed in that other way, but the Idaho Supreme Court over and over has held that it's to be read in the way that gives meaning to the commercial transaction piece of that provision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cutler, any reply?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to start with this last statutory point. and the alleged issue of not replying to the cases in the response brief. The reply categorizes all of those cases and identifies them as cases only addressing the second half of the statute. Under our argument, you break the statute in half at the second and clause, where it says and in any commercial transaction. Everything that precedes that allows attorney's fees in cases that are limited to collecting on or recovering on an unpaid amount associated with an open account, an account stated, or any of the other listed and enumerated things. After the and clause, there's a broader category of claims that are subject to fee shifting, any commercial transaction, not for personal or household services. And the reason that the courts just routinely cite that last phrase is most cases are brought underneath the broader category. They're not cases to collect an unpaid amount on an account stated, contract for services, or similar. And so every one of those cases is analyzing whether or not the issue is a commercial transaction and fits under this second bucket or second basket. And that's a way this court can, if the court reads it that way, it can read consistently Erickson, the Neumeier case in which my opposing counsel admitted that a debtor collected fees under the services prong without analyzing a commercial transaction in a case that would have been a personal services. You know, whether it's the debtor collecting fees or medical recovery, the contract at issue is the same, one for personal medical services. So the only way to read this statute consistently with all the case law is to read it the way that medical recovery asked this court to do. And that's consistent with 30 years of precedent. It puts all of the cases in the right basket in the category. The Kramer case in particular is a tort. It's a tort type issue in which the commercial transaction is at issue. So it's not, again, a claim to collect an unpaid amount. So all of their cases fit neatly into that criteria, and this court should maintain its 30 years of precedent consistent that the first half of the statute allows fees, whether it's personal services or not, as long as it's a claim to collect an unpaid amount for one of the listed things. Then moving to the prevailing party analysis, I'd like to reemphasize that I don't think it matters whether Mr. Getford received notice before the action with respect to Idaho Code Section 12-120, subsection 3. There is no notice requirement in that statute. And in fact, in most cases under that statute, you file a lawsuit whether or not you give notice to the other party. If it's a breach of contract claim or any other type of claim, there's never a notice inquiry. If you look at any of the 12-120 subsection 3 cases, they don't analyze whether there was pre-litigation notice. So there's no notice requirement on 12-120 subsection 3. So then it only comes down to whether or not Medical Recovery Services was a prevailing party. And in this case, it's clear that upon filing the complaint and serving it on Mr. Getford, he then paid the amount that we requested, giving the exact relief that we wanted. It's better than obtaining a judgment, because when you obtain a judgment as a debt collector, you have to be involved in post-judgment proceedings to collect that debt. That's not always easy. You know, often there's other debts that are outstanding and other judgments. Here, we received exactly what we wanted, payment upon filing of the complaint and serving that on Mr. Getford. And so we got exactly what we wanted on the one claim that we brought. And on top of that, there is an affirmative judgment establishing that Mr. Getford was liable. He was liable for the full 416. He made a payment on that 416, and that's why there's a $0 judgment. So to say that because it's a $0 judgment means that we didn't get anything against Mr. Getford is simply inconsistent with the record and inconsistent with what was found. I'd like to also address this argument that there was a finding that if Mr. Getford had received notice, he would have paid. I don't think the court will find that finding in the record. I didn't see any record citation in Ms. Dove's argument to where that's at. And I think if the court goes back and reads the magistrate court's decision and the district court's decision, it's going to find something along the lines of, gosh, I wish you were more diligent, and I wish you'd given him an opportunity to avoid these attorney fee payment. But I don't think you'll find any specific finding that Mr. Getford would have paid but for, you know, the failure to give notice. And again, even if that finding exists, I don't think that it matters, because you don't have an obligation to give somebody notice. There's no obligation to engage in pre-litigation settlement. If there's a breach of contract claim and the person is liable on the contract, you can file that claim whether or not you've tried to settle with them beforehand. So under the plain language of Rule 54D1B, the judgment in this matter was in favor of plaintiffs for the amount that was outstanding, and the statute clearly authorizes fees, and medical recovery would ask this court to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Cutler. The court appreciates the briefing and the argument in this case. The case is now fully submitted to the court. and we will issue an opinion in due course. Court will be in recess until June 16th.
Thank you.